ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if living offline isn't a choice anymore? I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm finding out just how much of our lives are online and whether we can ever really unplug. From privacy experts to hackers, we explore what it means to disappear in a world that's always watching. Opt Out. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, bringing you quiet relief on Christmas night and Boxing Day afternoon. A drive-in was built a few suburbs away from us when I was a kid, and we loved it. We tore around the place making trouble while our parents sat watching Hollywood movies on a screen twice as big as a tennis court. I was 8 at the drive-in when I saw Elizabeth Taylor and Peter Finch nearly trampled to death in Elephant Walk, and I've never forgotten it. But even before the drive-ins, there were open-air cinemas all over the country where you spread a blanket and watched under the stars. Later in the show, going to the movies en plein air. But first, for something like 30 years, Laura Tingle tangled with Philip Adams on Late Night Live to give you the most succinct, the most authoritative coverage of national politics anywhere on air. When she jumped ship to become the ABC's Global Affairs Editor, we sat down to talk about her long career on Canberra and Late Night Live. Week after week, we introduce Laura as our eyes and ears in Canberra. Well, it ain't a formula. It's the truth. Since Bob Hawke's time, this sharp, brave, independent spirit has been reporting politics as it is for us, for you, and for Australia. Laura, am I embarrassing you yet?
The blush is going up my head.
Okay, hold tight for more. Yeah. Laura has written for The Australian, The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald, The Financial Review, where she was political editor for 16 years until she joined the ABC in 2018 as the political editor of 7:30. Hers, of course, was already a familiar face on television, on Insiders. I mean, I was frequently on Insiders with Laura Tingle. And by the time Laura made the switch to the ABC full-time, she was, if you'll excuse me, Laura, a radio veteran. Here she is early on.
I'm now joined in our Canberra studio by Laura Tingle, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Australian. Now, Laura, before we look at various ethical problems raised by the issue of campaign funding, can you give us some idea, please, of the extent to which the major parties are supported by private funds?
Well, Philip, it varies fairly substantially. The notable thing about the current situation is the extent to which the Liberal Party hasn't been supported by outside interests in the last couple of years. I mean, if the Liberals lose this federal election, they're in very big trouble because they're about $11 million in debt.
Yeah. Well, are the laws of disclosure helping, Laura? Do you find it easy to keep track of who pays what to whom?
Well, the laws of disclosure currently drive anybody trying to work out what's going on demented, Philip, but partly that's because they've kept changing them, and partly that's because the Liberal Party has kept trying to stay one step ahead of the laws.
That was 1966, Laura with Philip Adams before his voice broke. Decades stretched ahead of them.
1996, now, David Marr. You just said 1966.
Oh, look, once again, I value your eye for accuracy. Now, we've done the maths, okay? By our calculations, Laura, you have appeared on Late Night to Live a little over 1,200 times. What is there left to say?
Well, politics is wonderful, so there's always something left to say, I think, David Marr. The strange thing about it is it's sort of circular, but there's some new personality or some new thing that's going on. in politics, which renders it interesting and worth discussing.
Is it over time the same thing again and again? Does everything just come around again? Does it all look sort of achingly familiar to you after all these years?
Yeah, which is when it's time to go, because it does start to look the same. Whether it's this thing came up last year with the government's aged care reforms, and I was the only person other than the two ministers who'd lost their political careers over it to recognise that part of the aged care reforms involved a policy that had derailed the Howard government for months back in the 90s. Now, of course, the context had changed, which is the thing about politics. You can have the same policy, but the context changes, and so it just went by with barely a blip. But you do sort of suddenly realise, I've done this before, I've heard this song before, and you can't ever sort of be complete. You know, it's good to have the background knowledge of it, but you've got to be perpetually excited by it. And if you can't be, it's time to get out.
What are the things that you've decided are never going to happen in Australian politics, even though they keep coming back and back?
Rational taxation of capital gains, rational taxation of our resources sector.
What do you mean, making gas producers pay?
Well, it's not about gas producers, but it's about resource somebody paying to dig all our resources out of the ground, and you know, which is something that belongs to all of us. Now, whatever the perils of the attempts to fix this in the Rudd era, that to me, as a country that's basically mostly about digging stuff up, is just an obscenity. Rationally fixing the taxation of transport in a way that this sounds a little bit nerdy, doesn't it, David? I'm sorry, but
no, you know, in this a country, ain't nerdy. This is basic. This is fundamental.
Yeah, in a country that is so big, we've got to actually fund our transport system in the correct way. I'm a bit more optimistic about climate in a fairly imperfect world now for climate policy. Will we ever quite get to fixing our relationship with our Indigenous peoples? I remain hopeful about that. But
despite the voice?
Well, despite a whole series of things, I think beyond the voice, there's no sort of framework anymore for working out what we're trying to do here, you know, in any shape or form, you know, about remote communities, about how you give people an opportunity, all of those really basic questions. So there are a few things that we don't seem to really do very well, and I'm not wildly optimistic about them.
What have you come to most admire in politicians?
What I've come to most admire in politicians is politicians who can think outside the square and who can take a risk and who can see an opportunity out of what might look like a debacle, who've got the capacity to change their own thinking and then lead a debate so that the rest of us are forced to rethink things as well.
Are there many of them?
No. But that's one thing. I suppose the other thing I admire is watching people come into the parliament knowing bugger all about anything and watching them absolutely just grow and expand under the weight of what you're exposed to in the parliament. I mean, you know, there are lots of flaws with our parliament, all of those sorts of things, but it's a great affirmation to me of the value of the parliament, that it is actually this real clearinghouse of information. Somebody like Jackie Lambie, who's come in, and everybody sort of loves Jackie. I don't know if she's going to survive this time around, but just watching people like her become really good, really thoughtful legislators, watching those really, you know, there've been a few seminal legislative debates in the chambers, particularly in the Senate, and the Mabo debate and the Wick debate were classics of the genre where...
Back in the 90s.
In the 90s, where people were debating clause by clause, often with very little background in the area. It was civil. It was not ideal. You know, people had different views, but it was not just ideological slagging off of each other. It was, yeah, but how will this work? And it was sort of both uplifting and sort of quite moving to watch them work together to get an outcome.
How do you handle coming to know politicians well, coming to know these people who you're reporting very well?
Well, in general, you aren't their friends. I mean, there are some people, and a really eccentric collection of people who you become friends with, but, you know, there has always got to be that gap. You can't sort of go, oh, well, you're my friend, so I'm not going to report on this. It is tricky, but... and often you end up being really good friends with people after they leave politics. But that's something that you learn and something that people who become friends with journalists tend to understand. You know, they don't expect you to be nice to them because, you know, you're on good terms with them. They know what goes in. And so it's hard, you know. So sometimes they don't like what you write. But then again, people who you're not friends with don't like what you like either. So
After a decade or so in the gallery, does information flow to you or are you seeking information out? I mean, do you become a sort of target of information in a way?
It becomes easier to get it. You know, when you're a young gallery reporter, or this is the story for me, and gallery reporting has changed a lot, but back in the day you might make 15 phone calls trying to get somebody to tell you something because you tended to be talking to the minions a bit more. When you've been there a while, if you need to know something, you can just go straight to the source, so to speak, and talk to them. So it becomes easier. And you also just read the plays a lot more. There've been a few things just in the last few weeks where, you know, in our conference call in the morning that we have at 7:30, people will be saying, "Oh, what's going to happen here?" And I'll say, "Well, I haven't actually spoken to anybody about this in the last 24 hours, but if this has happened, that means this is going to happen." And much to my own shock, I've been right.
Of course you have, of course.
it just becomes obvious what's you know, because you can just read the plays a lot better because you've got the background of it.
Do politicians come to you asking, trying to find out what the hell's going on?
No, not really. But, I mean, I think one of my laments is that... politicians don't have the sorts of relationships with journalists that they once had. Now, it might be good, really, but it used to be the case that the gallery was the clearinghouse for all political news. The cabinet was more often than not in Canberra. You know, it's a shock to remember that Parliament used to sit 5 days a week, David.
Good heavens.
Yes, shocking. And they'd hang about on weekends and things like that. So you did tend to, and because you often were specialists in a field, you develop, you know, much more regular interactions with people. And now they sort of fly around the country, they're dealing with whoever's, you know, available at the doorstop that day. And of course, your relationship also changes because you're getting old. I mean, when I started, I was in my early 20s, and, you know, Mr. Fraser, Mr. Hawke, you know.
What bullshit. You never sounded like that, but
yes,
go on.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. But I'm now, you know, and now I'm either the same age or older than prime ministers. And you know, a lot of the MPs will say, "Oh, I used to always listen to you on Late Night Live when I was at school." I remember hearing about you know, some story you'd written on Behind the News, and you just go, oh. So it does change your relationship with them.
Yes. On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and this is my exit interview with Laura Tingle as she abandoned us to take over the world. Were you always going to be a journalist? I mean, when did this ambition strike you?
Well, when I was little, the three choices that girls had at St. Michael's Land Cove was you're going to be a secretary, a nurse, or a nun. And, I briefly dabbled with being a missionary, I moved on from that. And somewhere in my teenage years, I liked to write, and I thought, maybe I could be a reporter, and with the idea of being a newspaper reporter. And everybody said in response, much to my annoyance, like your father. Because my father was a radio journalist with the ABC. My parents met at the ABC in the newsroom.
The ABC has been the source of a number of happy, long and productive marriages. Yes, go on.
So, and he was in television for a while with the ABC, and then he went into commercial radio. But I didn't associate it with what I wanted to do, because broadcasting, and by that stage he was, sort of doing talkback radio and things. So I didn't make the connection, and I was a bit intensely irritated that everybody else did. But that was where I sort of saw myself going.
Was part of it a sense that the country you were growing up in needed to be fixed?
I think as I moved closer to my 20s, I became much more of that view that there were these stories that weren't being told and, outrages that weren't being addressed and things like that. So this is Malcolm Fraser's Prime Minister at this point, and the various things that, and unemployment was, beyond whatever might have been the story with the dismissal, for people of my age, instead of this period where everybody used to just go on the dole for 12 months and, goof off, the times had become difficult, and the prospect of getting a job was suddenly quite hard, and inflation was high and wages were low. So I was sort of very sort of galvanised by all of those things, I think. And but I suppose to me journalism was this opportunity to be at the centre of things. So if there was a bit that I'd got from my father's career, it was that he always seemed to be the interesting bit. Like, he'd been at the Beatles press conference when they arrived in Australia, and he used to, I look back at it now and sort of think he used to give himself all the junkets. So we're always going out to the airport, because he would have been doing some trip to India or Papua New Guinea or somewhere. And so he sort of, it sort of seemed like he was always at the centre of things.
And you wanted to be too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, why wouldn't you want to be at the centre of things? It'd be great.
Absolutely. Did you enjoy learning to write?
As a journalist?
Yes.
Well, I, of course, started as a cadet at the Financial Review. And at that stage, the rule was basically that sub-editors weren't allowed to touch your copy, because it was all very specialised. And
wow.
So Ross Gittins, the economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, used to say of the Fin Review, if you're at the Fin Review, you never call a spade unless you can call it a digging implement. And the subs used to have a sweep about how long Anne Summers' longest sentence would be in her weekly column.
We did that at the National Times years later, but go on.
Yeah, so it really wasn't until I eventually ended up through various courses and sources at The Australian in 1987 where I had to learn how to write news properly. And I owe a great debt to both Dennis Shanahan and Paul Kelly for that. And they were very tolerant, and Kelly would come around, to check my copy every night, and he'd look over my shoulder, and I'd be going, it's pretty good, isn't it? And he'd say, yes, it's very good. I think you do need a verb in that sentence, though. So that was a...
God, we think back to those people with gratitude, don't we?
Yeah. I was very, very lucky in my early years. You know, I was mentored by Edna Carew at the Financial Review and Glenn Dyer and a whole series of people because they hadn't had a history of cadets at the Financial Review. And so I was a bit of a rarity, and I was literally 19 when I started.
Did you know anything about economics, anything about finance, anything about what the Financial Review actually reported?
Absolutely nothing. I didn't know why banks gave you interest. You know, I knew nothing. But, you know, but the lucky thing about it was that the year I joined was the year that the Campbell Report came out, which, of course, all listeners will be galvanised by, which was the report into the financial system. But it basically was sort of this Bible of how our financial system worked. So I was able to just read all of this and take it all in and be there right on the cusp of this, you know, 2 years before they floated the dollar, or maybe 18 months before they floated the dollar. So
you are what is called a quick study, aren't you?
Well, you know, I mean, it was just, and this, you know, talking about being at the centre of things, suddenly I'm exposed to all the really, really smart people, you know, the regulators, the people in business, the politicians, and I'm at the centre of things. And, you know, it wasn't theoretical. It was real. These were real-time debates going on about change.
At what point did you suddenly decide that you might try talking instead of writing? And what kind of challenge did that prove to be?
Well, I didn't really decide, but there weren't a lot of people around at that stage who knew about finance. So despite my very tender years, that gave me a bit of an in because people did suddenly want to talk about finance and economics and things. So, you know, I would come on programs like Late Night Live or whatever to talk about these things. And it is different. And I think I was probably a bit abominable at it. I mean, I still write my television scripts like I'm writing for newspapers, and, you know, all my colleagues sort of roll their eyes and go, that's not going to work when you're saying it out loud, Laura, even after 7 years. But, yeah, you have to learn to do it differently, I guess.
Is it easier to talk than write?
Oh, well, you can't go back and improve it. So you've just got to live with whatever you've said, which sometimes in my case is a little bit rash.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking with Laura Tingle about her life in the media, which is by no means over, but is about to take on the whole world as her field. Laura, let's go through the prime ministers you've known and what you think of them now, looking back. The first being?
Well, the first I covered in Canberra was Hawke.
Yep.
But I'd say something about Malcolm Fraser, who I, you know, door-stopped, you know, as a child in Sydney occasionally.
And reaching your microphone high up.
Excuse me, Mr. Fraser. And I used to say at, you know, writers' festivals and things Malcolm Fraser had been the Darth Vader of my childhood and become the Obi-Wan Kenobi of my later years, because we ended up being quite good pals, really. And it was really interesting to me to go back. It wasn't that I deliberately did that, but there'd be something that would come up which would force you to go back and look into the Hansard in the Parliamentary Library, which you did in those days, and just to see his social agenda and how much of the Gough Whitlam social agenda was actually pushed through the Parliament.
He preserved, like the Racial Discrimination Act.
Not
he
just preserved it. But some stuff that he actually put through himself, you know, areas like Social Security. So he was a really interesting character, you know, who I, of course, at the time, I, when I was a teenager, you know, he was just regarded as this sort of Thatcherite, you know...
Ogre. Particularly for the way in which he came to power.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, things like, you know, his position on apartheid and things like that. And they only... And it's, once again, as we were saying before, the context has changed, you know. Did Malcolm Fraser move to the left as he got older, or did the Liberal Party and Australia move to the right? Always, you know, we could debate it forever. But so he was interesting.
I want to debate that for a moment. Just in parentheses. Yes. We know where we're going. We're going to talk about prime ministers.
Right.
In the years that you have been a reporter, have you come to understand what left and right actually mean?
Well, I know what it's supposed to mean.
Oh, yeah, we all know that.
But I think they've just become, you know, terms of abuse now, really. You leftist, or, you know, so the sort of, you know, if you think the Liberal Party and the Coalition in general are supposed to be to the right, on so many things they are to the right, but in fact they're sort of also... even bigger agrarian socialists than the Country Party used to be, you know, and the Labor Party is a bit of a schmozzle itself.
Do you think it might be this, that the right represents that school of politics which is incredibly reluctant to spend public money, that it's all about returning as much tax as possible to people? The left have this tendency to spend public money for purposes.
I think it's more than just about spending money. I think it's actually about believing in government. You know, like, you know, that they actually don't believe in government. Like, the contempt that the Coalition has shown for the administrative functions of government over the last 20 years is quite extraordinary. They don't actually believe that governments should do stuff. And that's sort of been illustrated by the way they've used consultants in areas where they shouldn't be consultants. I mean, I'm all for efficiency. That's fine.
And skill and talent.
Yeah. But, of course, one of my big, hobby horses is institutional memory, and the fact that the Coalition in general doesn't value the institutional memory you get from having a continuity of public servants who know what they're talking about. And who always presume that if they get a consultant in to look at something, they will give you a better answer than somebody who's actually been working the system for a really long time.
Mm. Close parentheses, back to prime ministers. Does Hawke deserve the sort of afterglow that he's been given?
It's interesting. I mean, my view of Hawke may have been heavily influenced by the fact that for most of the time all of the time he was Prime Minister, I was writing about economics. So my sort of major focus was on the Treasurer, a couple of Treasurers after Keating in the Hawke era, or at least one, two. And to me, the dynamism of that government on economics came from Keating. And that was certainly the story that he pushed. It's really only through sort of different paths I've come to appreciate Hawke's quite extraordinary intellect. One of them was when I briefly went back to university and I was reading some of his early wage case submissions and a few other things he wrote about Papua New Guinea or something. No, that might have been John Kerr. But he wrote these things which were just startlingly brilliant. And then I was asked to interview Hawke and Keating in 2003 for the 20th anniversary of their election. And it was absolutely fascinating to hear the two of them talk about the government, you know, that completely different perspectives or frameworks of thinking about it. But, you know, that I was much more impressed as a result by Hawke. But I could never see what the attraction of him was, politically, to voters. I didn't get that at all. I never found him a particularly persuasive advocate. He wasn't particularly good in the parliament, but without a doubt, He was smart enough to ride what Bill Hayden had set up for him, and to, you know, use his personality and persona as the great conciliator, and to be able to drive that really quite extraordinary cabinet that prevailed during those first 4 or 5 years in particular of the Hawke government.
Was the Hawke Keating government the most effective, the most perhaps intelligent that you've reported?
Without a doubt, absolutely. You had all of these ministers who were very serious about what they did, very good at the politics of it, very good at the policy. They're all really invested in the policy, and you know, their collective capacity to change courses from what they'd all been planning to do because of events, my dear boy, was extraordinary.
Then John Howard. How did Australia change under John Howard, do you think?
I just point out, David Marr, that we didn't mention Paul Keating as Prime Minister, but we can move on to John Howard.
Laura, a moment ago I talked about the Hawke-Keating government. Would you like to say something in particular about Paul Keating? He deserves it.
I think they're very different governments.
Ah, they should not be, as I did, lazily allied them.
I don't think it was lazy, but, you know, it's a reasonable enough thing. But Keating always says that, you know, he missed his big chance because he should have taken over earlier. And I think the thing about, you know, it was an interesting government, but it was a tired government. You know, it didn't have that sort of force of cabinet that they'd had in the early years. And I think also, thinking about this today, the thing about Keating and his effectiveness in the Hawke years was that he was such a persuader and he wanted to persuade people and he wanted to get change. And he sort of went into a bit of a funk after he won the 93 election, having put all of that effort into defeating John Hewson and Fight Back, and having gone through the recession and all those sorts of things, and then wanting to go into different areas like the Republic, like foreign policy, like Mabo. He put a lot of effort into some of those things and did so really brilliantly, but he had basically become, what's the word? He resented the sense that he had to persuade people, and particularly he took that out on the press gallery because he thought that the gallery should have backed him more in 93. And so I think his prime ministership, you know, had some really good things going in it, but of course it was very different economic times, very different issues, I think the prime ministership suffered because of that, you know, the sense of, well, I'm, you know, I've done my bit of explaining, I'm not going to do more of it.
I'm just going to lay down the law.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, John Howard.
Yes, John Howard.
Yeah. So, John Howard, I often joke that I blame John Howard for everything, which is, it is a joke.
But people
okay?
do, and it is not fair.
But, I mean, when I say that, it's not about necessarily policy issues, but it's about the way he changed politics. And it's not even on issues, people often say he introduced race to our politics. That's not quite right.
He took it to Canberra.
He certainly took it to Canberra long before he was Prime Minister. I think he skirted around it because of the Hanson phenomenon. And if you compare his position on One Nation preferences with that of Peter Dutton, he looks relatively noble, you'd have to say. But the things that he changed and that changed with him were perpetual campaigning, that, you know, you didn't just go out, you know, once every 3 years and campaign, you did it every day of the week. He changed the way people judged what was good in politics. So a lot of my younger colleagues have grown up in an era where you give people marks for being clever, for getting away with things, not for whether what they've done is a good thing or a bad thing.
The tactics.
Yeah. And I think that's bad. And I always quote this old coalition staffer who became a pollster, who became a lobbyist, who said to me early in the Howard years, I said to him, what's different? He said, well, with the Hawke Keating government, if you wanted to persuade a minister on something, you'd take in some economic modelling. But if you wanted to persuade the Howard government, you take in some polling. And I think there really was a really huge mindset. Of course, he started to really attack the public service. He did some really stupid things on privatisation, like selling off the Foreign Affairs building, you know, a purpose-built building which we now pay for in rent what we pay to build it every year or something.
If I ever knew that, I've forgotten it.
Oh, yeah, no, it's...
He sold it off to a private landlord.
The first you know, iteration of the government, they had this really stupid, really ridiculous rule, which I still get quite cross about, as may be obvious, where they said unless a building was returning something like 12.5% a year, it had to be sold, and all these other things were sold. And so none of that was very good. And they cut spending in their first year or so quite savagely, and some of those cuts were actually reasonably well done and stuck, but a lot of them didn't. And after that, they just coasted. So all the stuff about what... They had the minerals boom. They never cut spending in any serious way after that first go at it. So they weren't particularly good economic managers. And then, of course, he absolutely squandered the commodities boom in rounds of tax cuts to get himself re-elected and, you know... Politicians do that, but I sort of think that while you could give him credit for reforming tax and introducing a GST, the way they eventually did that was such that it has actually made it almost impossible to further reform the tax system. You know, the, you know, too clever by half thing of making the GST a state tax.
Yes.
The structure of the tax scales that they introduced, which makes it incredibly hard to move them without it being incredibly expensive. The unwinding of the capital gains tax regime that had been put in place. The first homeowners grant being given to everybody instead of just to people buying a new house. There were so many bad bits of how that tax reform ended up being bastardised.
Most of which are still with us.
Absolutely.
Let's move from Mr. Howard to Mr. Rudd. Was he... in the end, the most disappointing Prime Minister that you've reported?
I don't know if he was disappointed.
Oh, that's a big claim, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I don't think he was disappointed. They did try to do a lot of things. They were very, very ambitious and, you know, didn't always work. I know people in the government were saying, oh, you've got no idea what it was like, Laura. It was just terrible. We couldn't get anything done. But I still just think it was so profoundly stupid to roll him. Just so profoundly stupid that, you know, that they were incapable of, you know, just working around him if that was what was necessary to get stuff done. They were ministers of the Crown. You know, they can do things. They're in the Constitution. He isn't. I think he was possibly a disappointment to voters, but not really until that very last few months where he sort of backed off on climate, but he had enormous levels of support, which, you know, yes, he should have been able to do more with, and he obviously had personality flaws which made it really difficult, but. There was still lots of stuff they did do.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, with my old friend and colleague Laura Tingle, as she put Canberra behind her to take on the world. Laura, when you were doing radio, we rarely talk face-to-face. I mean, it's wonderful, you know, yeah. Today... we are face-to-face in the studio, indeed. I mean, what are you doing as you talk to us? Are you in deep contemplation or do you get on with things?
Look, I've, I've actually spoken to you and your predecessor, the excellent Mr. Adams, in all sorts of wild and strange places, often outside restaurants in Canberra, where I might have been having dinner with a politician.
Where passing traffic can be heard.
Yes, exactly. Once I was standing on a train station in Germany when I was talking to Philip about, I don't know, 5 years ago, on my way to hear, I think, Angela Merkel speaking at a rally at the Hamburg fish markets. that was quite colourful. But often in the olden days, Monday night would be my night for cooking up food for the family for the week. So I'd be sweating over the pot of bolognese or something as I spoke. In more recent years, the cat and I have tended to be, here's a confession. There was a stage when I used to actually sit in bed and talk on the radio because my daughter was small, my husband was asleep on the couch down the other end of the house, so I had to be in bed.
I'm not saying you shouldn't have been, Laura. You've got a look on your face as though that you've got to explain yourself. If you want to speak to the nation from bed, then that's
Jimmy
fine.
Dance, yeah.
But the problem was the cat.
So, so Boo Cat and I spend a bit of time together these days in a solitary, well, you can't be solitary, but the two of us spend a bit of time together. And whenever I start to talk, if I'm talking to somebody on the phone or the radio or a Zoom call or something like that, Boo Cat just presumes that I'm talking to her, so she wants to join the conversation. And I have been known to be lying on the couch of an evening talking to you, and so she comes and sort of sits on my chest and is often sort of only that far away from the telephone when
you
we're talking.
You don't think, though, that some listeners already know this, Laura? I mean, there is a particular growl that cat has, which I wish was you. It's a growl of anger and attention-seeking and demand, all the things that you're too polite to show except, you know, at the edges. And there's this cat going... There's also the bell, the tinkling of the bell.
Really? I don't hear the bell, so...
A few weeks ago, the bell chimed in just perfectly as our conversation ended. It was as if it had been done by a musician. Ding! The bell came on.
I was actually thinking of bringing her in today and I forgot.
I'm glad you didn't. I can't bear cats. That was Laura Tingle, leaving us to become ABC's Global Affairs Editor. Coming up, Cinema Under the Stars. Here's a trivia question and answer to keep up your sleeve. You never know when it'll come in handy. In which country will you find the world's oldest open-air picture show still operating? Australia, of course. It's in Broome. It's called Sun Pictures, and it's been going for a century, actually a little bit more. And from my guest, Rory Elkington, that open, corrugated iron shed is a totem of the love this country has never lost for going to the pictures, indoor and out. Rory is a senior lecturer in creative industries at the Queensland University of Technology, QUT, who has, with one of his colleagues, been researching cinema going in this land. Rory, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
Can we have a language note before we begin? When I was a kid, we went to the pictures, and then at a certain point they became the movies, and now they're cinema. When did this happen? Why did this happen? Do they mean different things? This is,
I think they can absolutely mean different things to different people. But I really am quite deliberate in my choice of the word cinema going, because it's in the going, David, that is actually the vital step. You know, we need to get up, we need to put on our hard clothes, we need to leave our house and go to that place. So that's the fundamental action for me.
Getting up off our bums, going out, and then sitting down with a room full of strangers to watch a film which, if we were just patient for a few weeks, we could watch on television at home.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Sun Pictures. Who opened it? Why? And where does it fit in the pattern of outdoor cinema going?
So the founder of Sun Pictures was a master pearl diver in Broome, a man by the name of Ted Hunter. And we've got to remember that at the time in 1916, this was really bleeding edge technology. I mean, the profession of pearl diving is still around, but it would be, I suppose, a bit today like a pearl diver suddenly getting into blockchain or AI. It was a pretty wild thing to do. But he took a punt in true kind of entrepreneurial Australian spirit. And that chance that Ted Hunter took, which was in some ways quite a low barrier of entry, it was a very basic setup. They had a projector, of course, and they had a screen. There wasn't a roof, because indeed it is an outdoor cinema. But that punt, 100 years later, is still going strong. And it's an incredible testament to the long and rich history of not just cinema, but outdoor cinema going in Australia in terms of Sun Pictures and Broome. It's a wonderful place.
Why do we love doing things outdoors that we could perfectly happily do indoors? I mean, why do we want, what is it in us? Why do we want to eat outdoors, sleep outdoors, watch the pictures outdoors?
Well, part of it, I think, is we're blessed with incredible outdoors in Australia. So we kind of, a bit like cinema going itself, we're so familiar with it, so we sort of lose track of how incredible it is. But we do have wonderful outdoors, David. So I think that approach of us being out and in it is important. And you mentioned food, and I think that's a good example to go to, because if anyone's had that experience of a very simple meal, a picnic being transformed by being and plein air, by being outside, it's distinct, and it's almost it catches you by surprise how different it can be. And it's quite like cinema going. On one level, you're right, you can watch a movie at home, and going outside to, you know, whether it be a drive-in or a public screening in a park put on by your local council, it seems quite mundane. But there's something about that experience, being out and allowing your focus to be on the screen and then for it to shift into the environment and the outdoors that is around us. It's a really, really distinct experience, and it's quite a unique and special one.
And it's festive as well, isn't it? Because in summer in Europe, outdoor cinemas in, you know, Spain and Italy, places with a steady, warm nighttime climate, they turn squares into cinemas. It's part of celebration of summer.
Absolutely. Bologna in Italy, they put three enormous piazzas over to a festival, and crowds spill in and are sitting with rapt attention. So Europe, obviously, during summer, has a great deal of focus towards this communal experience, people coming together for something that, as you say, is very, very familiar, but very, very unique when we have the opportunity to do it in an outdoor setting and, crucially, with other people.
In Broome at Sun Pictures, there is also a history there of Australian race, isn't there?
Indeed, there is. So in the article that we wrote, we identify the fact that this was a segregated cinema, as many, many cinemas were during that time in Australia. And really, it wasn't until Charles Perkins' Freedom Ride through rural New South Wales in 1965 and beyond that there was a quite deliberate breakdown of segregation within cinemas in Australia. So that was in place in Broome in the early years, just as it was across Australia. And it's good that that history is known, because thankfully we're far from it today.
How did it work?
Oh, literally there was segregation for First Nations people to the side, Malays and Filipino people and other folk were off to the side. And it may not surprise you to know the Anglo-Australians, white Australians were playing in the middle.
Had the best seats. And down the front were?
The kids were down the front, and it's interesting because since the article I've been contacted by a few folk who grew up with Sun Pictures, and the kind of nice flip side to that segregation account for the adults is that that was not the case, and it would have been way too hard to manage for the kids. So the kids actually had an opportunity to get together, to break down that segregation and mix and enjoy that cinema without those kind of clear racial lines. So that is a good thing.
Rory, you've mentioned twice the article. This is the article in...
The Conversation.
The Conversation.
Thank you.
Yes. And amongst other things, I understand you could sit there in your deck chairs, there were deck chairs, with the water lapping around your feet.
Look, there are some wonderful accounts, David, of some localised flooding and fish swimming around people's legs as they sat watching, taking in a film on their deck chair, which I think we can agree is a pretty unique outdoor cinema experience.
Anywhere else in Australia where you can regularly, all year round, watch a film under the stars?
Absolutely, in terms of the drive-in movie experience.
Now, you equate the two, or you link the two.
Absolutely, yes. But drive-ins occupy a really interesting space because it's almost as if you're taking your living room out with you as you go. But David Kildare, who I spoke to for this article, makes a really interesting point that for the drive in Australia, it was this coming together of these two icons of Australia, which is the motion picture and the automobile. And we were able to combine them in such an effective way. And drive-ins were massively, massively popular right on through to the 60s and 70s in Australia. However, a whole combination of factors of land tax and traffic and the upkeep of these sites has meant that there has been far, far fewer of them. However, I would say that there is a new drive-in that's been suggested for Perth in WA. That's going through a lot of processes. Yes, well, there's a lot of community consultation, as you might imagine.
I can imagine. Within a few years of Sun Pictures opening in Broome, Walter Burley Griffin was building an extraordinary palace of a theatre in Melbourne, the capital. That was another kind of cinema experience, wasn't it? As was the State Theatre in Sydney, sort of an immense palace. What was that about?
I think that was about people with funds who took a chance. The cinema operation business, the motion picture business, is always a risky one. But I think for people that had the resources and were in love with the form, with film, I think this was a chance that they were willing to take. But you're right, the history of these sites, these places where we can go as Australians and experience cinema going, is incredibly varied. Everything from Sun Pictures all the way through to, say, the State Theatre in Sydney, and a lot of sites in between. And we can even take it down a notch into, you know, what is effectively outdoor park screenings put on by a local council, which can be, you know, really quite rough around the edges in many ways. But there's something about that site being created. There's something about some speakers being put up and a screen being put up and people coming together that still engages us, whether it be in a picture palace or whether it be on a deck chair in Sun Pictures.
When cinemas disappear, they leave an extraordinary hole in a community, don't they? They are amongst the most mourned buildings.
And as someone who watches this space quite closely, I'm really familiar with that outpouring of kind of grief and regret that you've identified, David. We see it a lot on social media when a cinema closes. And for anyone who's listening that has access to perhaps a local cinema, a community cinema, and they think about going to it, it's important, I feel, that we don't wait for that moment to happen and then do the regret piece.
Now, I want you to throw away all of your academic sense of balance and tell me what the best cinema in Australia is. Which one?
Look, for me, and as a great fan and resident of Brisbane, I feel bad about saying this, but the State Cinema in Sydney is a very, very special place. For festivals, for events that I've been to in the past, it may not have the best acoustics. It may not even arguably have the best screen, but there's something about stepping into that venue and the memories I have of that venue that for me are absolutely unique, and I hope it is with us forever.
I can remember from my childhood the organ coming up out of the pit and somebody playing on the... The organ is still crashed, isn't it? Or is it? Do you know whether it's been restored? It was such an experience.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I really like a very, very simple two-screen cinema that I'm able to go into and has just a handful of seats. I mean, one thing that people may not know is Australians invented gold class. We invented that idea for cinemas and we exported it to the world. So I do love that kind of deep experience of kind of immersing yourself and just enjoying a small theatrette.
Rory, thank you very much. I've been speaking to Rory Elkington, who is a senior lecturer in creative industries at QUT, Queensland University of Technology, who has been examining what a superb subject cinema going in Australia. That's the show and another week of Late Night Live Summer. My thanks as always to the producers who made this show possible all year. Catch you next week with more of our best from the year that was.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.